You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome back to another edition of GNAT TV's In-Depth Series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's News Project. It's a pleasure to have you with us today on Friday, October 11th. I don't think so. Anyway, great to have you all with us today. Great to be joined by my friend and colleague, Greg Sukenik from the Manchester Journal, Bennington Banner, and Brattleboro Reformer. Greg, good to have you along today.
It's good to be here again, Pat Andrew. Thank you very much.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, we had the pleasure of doing an interview together with Senator Patrick Leahy, and that was so much fun, we decided, why should we stop there? So we were very fortunate to be able to arrange some time today to talk to Congressman Peter Welch, who is Vermont's sole representative in the U.S. Congress. He's represented the state since 2007. And, of course, many of you will remember last November, Congressman Welch announced that he would be throwing his hat in the ring for the Senate seat that Senator Leahy will be vacating, I guess, later this year. So, Congressman, thanks again for making the time to be with us. And, Greg, I'm going to turn it over to you to get us started here.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Thank you for being with us, Congressman. Our first question. The invasion of Ukraine has sent gas and diesel prices skyrocketing and shows the risk of our dependence on fossil fuels. But this comes as we're trying to transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy. So should we kick the can for now to avoid runaway inflation at the pump and in our economy? Or do we take our medicine and double down on renewables because we've seen what that reliance on fossil fuel does?
Well, you know, it's short term and long term. I mean, the prices are brutal. I mean, I just filled up my car, $55, and prices are going up all around. I just got my chainsaw retuned, and I think it was twice the cost of what it was last year. So this is tough. Now, luckily, we're starting to come out of the winter heating season, but we're still in it. So bottom line here, this is really tough, and we have to do something in the short term. And those short-term things that are aggravated by Putin's horrific war, I'm really willing to consider, do we suspend the gas tax for a period of time? Number two, do we want to increase subsidies like the low-income heating assistance that will get us through and give help to folks who are really struggling with this? But three, you know, the oil companies have the capacity to increase production and bring supply closer to demand. And they've got wells that they're not drilling. They've got gas that they're not transporting. And a significant part of that is because they have done very well with these the lower production and the higher prices. And in fact, they have the opportunity, the ways, the means, and the resources to bring up supply that I think needs to be done at this point. So short term, it's everything from subsidizing folks who are getting hammered, but it also is asking our oil companies to not profiteer and to increase supply in the short term. But as far as the long term, absolutely, we should redouble our commitment to renewables because there's two issues. Number one, energy independence, and the more energy that we create here at home, and that can be renewable, the more local, the better. And obviously, we can't act as though climate change isn't real. So some of the things in Build Back Better that are stalled in the Senate on the climate side, really we need to do. Like, for instance, those tax incentives to help make electric vehicles affordable, including the F-150 truck, by the way, the most popular vehicle in the country. Charging stations that would be available so that people would have confidence that they could recharge, just like they have confidence now that they can fill up. Having a transmission system, a grid that is resilient and strong and able to transmit renewable energy, say from wind farms in Iowa to Minneapolis. You know, that has to be done. And that's all energy that we can produce here. It means that we're not dependent on the Middle East or Russia, and it also means that we can start tackling climate change. So short term, we've got to do, it's like, you know, you look at on a cold day, you look at your fuel tank and you're almost not empty, that's not the time you put up the solar panel. You need a refill. Mm-hmm. But after you get into the spring, you might start thinking, hey, you know what? I might want to start figuring out how to heat where I don't have to depend on that fuel truck showing up at 2 a.m.
Well, Congressman, just to stick with sort of current events here, obviously we've all been closely following the situation in Ukraine and watching some of the very tragic video and news footage that's been coming out from there. I guess I was just wondering, one issue that seems to be bubbling up is whether or not the United States should impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine to assist the Ukrainians to resist the Russian advances. But there is two sides to that story, and I guess I just wondered what you thought about that. Is that an option we should be seriously considering, or is that just too fraught with potential widening the war beyond what it already is?
Okay, I would like with every fiber of my being to promote a no-fly zone, but I don't think we should. And the reason is this. The catastrophic war that we're trying to stop can't become a means of starting a war that involves nuclear weapons, and that could happen. A no-fly zone has to be enforced, and it would mean that we, or NATO, and that's us, would be in direct combat with Russian air assets. And it's hard for me to be confident that that wouldn't result in an escalation that would lead us very potentially into the exchange of nuclear weapons or the use of nuclear weapons by Russia. So would I like to do it? The answer is yes. Should we do it? Do I think it's wise? Right now, I think the answer is no. So everything we can do, and of course, this is bipartisan, we've supported more and more military aid. We just voted on $13 billion, almost $14 billion of a combination of military aid for Ukraine and humanitarian aid. And of course, our NATO partners in many neutral countries that are not part of NATO are joining us in the sanction effort and in the relief effort.
The Postal Service Reform Bill has passed both houses and on its way to the White House. I know this is an issue that you've been tracking pretty closely. Are you pleased with the bill? And that's the first part of the question. The second part of the question is, do you still believe that a change in leadership at the Postal Service is the next step?
Well, I am really pleased. We've been working on this for 4 or 5 years, and the squeeze was on. And one of the most wonderful experiences I've had in Congress was when I went up and joined folks in Elmore, you know, population, 1,800, to save their local post office. It was in the Elmore store, which is right on Lake Elmore. Folks have post boxes there, and the Postmaster General was going to get rid of it as a, quote, cost-saving measure, even though that would have been really hard for the community and really hard on the viability of that store that is the center of life. And when I went up there, the whole town was out. And it had kids from first to fourth grade with signs saying, save our store, save our post office. So the Postal Reform Act is really going to help. And it was overdue. And again, it's another example where we actually got to a bipartisan compromise and passed legislation that's going to be really good for Vermont. The leadership issue, I've had real problems with DeJoy, and I've asked that he be replaced. That has to be up to the Postal Commission. It's not a presidential appointment. But you know what? I want to acknowledge something. I'm getting the Postal Reform Bill and getting many Republican votes. Mr. DeJoy, in fact, was helpful on that. So I have to pay respect where respect is due. When it came to getting those bipartisan votes we needed, the Republican votes, he actually threw himself into it and was helpful in that.
When we spoke with Senator Leahy a couple of weeks ago, Congressman, we spent a fair amount of time talking about a point you just alluded to right there in your answer about the post office, about bipartisanship and how getting things done in Congress has changed over time. I mean, obviously, Senator Leahy goes back to the 1970s and probably remembers a lot of history there. But our point was basically that it seems like from the outside that, the internal dynamics of Congress seem to be a lot harder than they used to be to get bills passed, to get folks from both sides of the aisle to kind of sign on and agree with it. And I guess I just wondered, what is your general thought at this point about whether or not we're going to see a kind of a pathway back to a time when Republicans and Democrats could sit down, work together, come up with a bipartisan solution to whatever problem they were trying to get to? Or are we so locked into this sort of polarized situation that it's going to be hard to get out of it?
Well, you know, it's a question that I struggle with every day. And, you know, Andrew, you've just outlined, I think, what Vermonters prefer. They'd like, you know, we in Vermont have differences, but we don't assume that somebody who disagrees with us doesn't have the same goal of making it a better town meeting or making it a better state than we do just because we disagree. It's a lot different in Congress now, especially after January 6th, where you literally had an attack on the Capitol and where subsequently 147 of my colleagues voted to overturn the election. But there's really kind of two levels where it operates. You know, on that, what the news is showing constantly is the conflict, and the differences are enormous. And you get behavior that is, in my view, really extreme, where, for instance, members of Congress are shouting out at a president as he gives the State of the Union address in ways that I think are quite inappropriate and not civil. But below that, there's also some things that we work on that actually have been bipartisan and are getting some things done that the American people need. The Postal Reform Act, it was really hard, and it had been partisan for a long time, but finally we had a breakthrough, and this is going to be beneficial. Another example is the infrastructure bill. You know, we're going to get a couple $100 billion here in Vermont for broadband. We're going to get millions and millions for roads and bridges. And we're going to have safer intersections that are going to benefit you, whether you are driving your child to school and you voted for Trump, and you're driving your child to school and you voted for Biden. That was bipartisan. The American Rescue Act, where that money was so essential when we had to close our economy down because of COVID. What were restaurants going to do? What were our shuttered venues going to do, like the Paramount in Rutland or the Flynn in Burlington? You know, Manchester Arts. And we did that with a number of Republican votes. So what I see in my day-to-day life in Congress is really, it's almost schizophrenic, because there's performance in by extreme members, and there's the doers who are trying to figure out, how do we get this rescue package passed? How do we focus on infrastructure and get our roads and bridges? How do we get broadband to our communities? So, you know, ultimately, it's up to each of us to do our level best to focus on problems and solutions. And what I've found is that when I identify something that affects us in rural Vermont, like the lack of broadband, I can assume that's a challenge for my Republican colleagues in Kansas or in Oklahoma. And it's a reason why, for instance, just as an example, I started the broadband caucus that was bipartisan. And I approached my colleagues, Republican and Democrat. Republicans were the ones I really was focusing on. And instead of talking to them, did they vote for Trump, or why did they vote for, you know, didn't vote for impeachment, or all these things that I did, I asked them, how's your broadband? And then you could hear me talking about the problems we have in Vermont about broadband. So that's the way I try to approach it, to find common problems where, by bringing them up and showing my concern, we can get to common solutions.
You mentioned the January 6th insurrection. I was wondering if your take on the pace of progress right now by the January 6th commission, by the way it's conducted its investigation so far, and whether you are confident that that it will lead to action by the Department of Justice.
I have no idea whether it will lead to action by the Department of Justice. And in fact, well, that, you know, the Department of Justice, as you know, is prosecuting many of the folks who attacked the Capitol and harmed our police officers and damaged the property in there. So that is happening. But the real objective of the January 6th Commission is to get the facts, who did what, when, why, and where, and to lay that out in historical perspective for the American people. And it's pretty shocking, everything they're finding, because it's millions and millions of dollars that was spent by the Trump campaign to facilitate the organization of that effort. The invitation to people to come there, the communications with emails and text among a lot of the Trump officials and people who were in the insurrection. And, you know, the promotion of the big lie that I think was really a horrible thing that former President Trump did. You know, we have in this country, and it's so essential to the well-being of our democracy in the future, and it has been in the past, the peaceful transfer of power and the acceptance that the people of this country, through their vote, decide who their leader is. That is up to them and them alone. And when we saw members of Congress essentially using their position, where our job is simply to certify what the people have done and turn that into the right of that member of Congress to decide what he or she wanted to be done, that's sabotaging a fundamental principle that it's the people, not the politicians, who elect our leaders. And I think that's got to be laid out in clear detail. And I believe that Chairman Thompson and the committee is doing a very, very good job, despite resistance all along the way.
There's in a number of quarters, there's criticism of the Attorney General for not acting faster. Do you count yourselves among those who are concerned about the pace of action or inaction on his part? Or are you still willing to be patient for a while?
Well, I want to get the facts, and the facts take some time, and there's an immense amount of resistance. And this is more the January 6th Commission. But as you know, a lot of the folks who have been subpoenaed are resisting. They're doing that on the advice, oftentimes, of Donald Trump himself, don't cooperate. And it's a process that takes time when people won't cooperate, and you have to go to court to get that. You know, the Attorney General's got to be really careful on this. Because everything, in order for it to be credible, he's got to play it straight and play it by the books and take the time that's required. I mean, I have confidence that he's on the level in this pursuit. It's something I did not have confidence in when it was Attorney General Barr. I mean, what he did with the Mueller report was outrageous. He basically whitewashed it. And I am appreciative of an Attorney General being sober, careful, even if it means a lot of us who would like to know as much as we can, as soon as we can, have to be a little more patient.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So I assume that means, Congressman, you're not going to run out and buy Bill Barr's new book. That's what I'm saying this week.
Well, you know, he did a terrible thing. You know, he politicized the Justice Department. And, you know, just think about just a couple of two things that he did that were really, really, I think, across the line. When people were demonstrating outside the White House, he went on the march with President Trump when he did that stunt of holding up the Bible in front of the St. John's Church across from the Capitol, and he was there with the Attorney General. And as you know, there was specific instructions given to the guard and the protective the police out there to disperse the crowd who was assembling lawfully. You know, an Attorney General should not be doing that. And the other thing he did on the Mueller report, you know, the Mueller report came out. The Attorney General had an opportunity to hold on to it for 30 days before it was released. And what Attorney General Barr did was sanitize it. He gave his own version of it, and he released that as though it was the full report. And it was extremely misleading, but it had the intended effect. And of course, Trump claimed that he was exonerated, which he was not. In that whole thing, you know, we were talking about the Ukraine earlier. You know, I went to Ukraine in 2016. And we met at that time, the president was not Zelensky. It was Poroshenko. And we were, I was there with Kevin McCarthy. I was on a Republican delegation. And a major focus of our attention was the military needs that the Ukrainians needed to defend themselves. And we were talking about Stinger missiles, which now, of course, are a staple of their defense. And fast forward, that phone call that President Trump had with President Zelensky, where after Congress had approved military aid, the president turned it into an opportunity to squeeze Zelensky into doing a dirty work for him to try to dredge up info on Biden to assist Trump in his campaign. And I believe that was an impeachable offense. And in fact, I voted to impeach Trump for that. And the report that Mueller did really confirmed a lot of what that phone call said. And Bill Barr, as Attorney General, whitewashed that. So I'm not buying his book. You're right about that.
Well, I wanted to ask you a quick question before we have to run about the spending bill that Congress voted through earlier this week, a $1.5 trillion appropriation omnibus bill. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what's in that for Vermont. I gather there's a certain amount of money that will be coming our way to fund certain projects here in the state.
Well, it's true. I mean, first of all, it's funding all of government. So it's everything from the Pentagon to the Department of Agriculture to the National Endowment for the Arts. And the way we've had gridlock in Washington, the normal passage of a budget, it should have been done last year in time for the beginning of the fiscal year, which was October 1 of last year. So I'm not here bragging that we did our job because we did it late. But it's tough in this environment that you were referring to, Andrew. So I feel good that we've got a budget. It gives stability and certainty to our governmental agencies. It gives stability and certainty to Vermont in our agencies. That's good. Now, this is the first time we've been able to have congressionally designated spending in a number of years. And of course, Vermont is so fortunate because Senator Leahy, as the chair of the Appropriations Committee, has been really instrumental in steering money to projects that have broad support in Vermont. He's done so much for agriculture. There's money in there to help us deal with that. Lake Champlain, Senator Sanders has been able to get some projects in there that help with workforce training and the nursing shortage. And I've been able to get some projects in that help some community projects, like some community efforts. Like, for instance, up in St. Johnsbury in the Northeast Kingdom, the Fairbanks Museum is going to get a couple of million dollars to put an addition on that is going to help in the education and science services that they provide to so many people in the community. We're going to be able to get a park that the folks in Derby Line have been trying to get to benefit the community. So we can provide everybody with a list of those specific congressionally designated projects. But I got to say, nobody's better at it than Senator Leahy. And God bless him. He served us so well for these 48 years.
You are running for the United States Senate. So I just wonder just really quickly what your main priorities would be if elected.
Well, serve Vermont. You know, I want to keep serving Vermont. I feel so lucky that for these past 16 years, we've gone through so many things. When I started out, we had the financial crisis and the collapse of Wall Street that really hammered Main Street. And we had to react and try to help Vermonters get through that. We had Tropical Storm Irene. And now, of course, we had COVID. And now we have the aftermath of COVID and the effect of Putin's war in Russia with inflation. All of these things are challenging. And every day I've had an opportunity to try to be helpful to Vermonters. And it's everything from somebody having trouble with their Social Security check and being able to help them get that ironed out, to a visa problem and being able to help a family member get the help and service that they need, to being able to help so much to get aid here to allow recovery after our roads and bridges were demolished in Tropical Storm Irene. And now to have been part of the delegation with Bernie and Patrick to get COVID relief back here to Vermont, it has been such a lifeline for us. So my priority is to help Vermont. That has been what I have done from day one, and it's what I feel so blessed to have an opportunity to do. But the big challenge for Vermont now is affordability. You know, Vermont, this is not unique to Vermont, but I think it's intense in Vermont. The cost of housing, you know, with COVID, it's really made what has been unaffordable housing really be way out of reach. And it's why the COVID relief money that is coming to Vermont and the governor and the legislature are putting into housing. Affordable housing is so important. Childcare. You know, a young family with two kids in Vermont, they pay about 30% of their income for childcare. And every family has that discussion. Should one of us drop out of the labor force because it's cheaper for us to be at home than going to work? Well, if we pass the childcare bill in Congress that we did in the House, but it stalled in the Senate, that 30% would come down to 7%. I want to get the cost of prescription drugs down. You know, we passed my legislation for price negotiation on prescription drugs in the House. It stalled in the Senate. But folks who need insulin, they're getting hammered on the cost. This would cap it, if you've got insurance, for $35 a month. So these affordability issues are really, really challenging to us. And the other thing that we have to make progress on is climate. You know, it's everybody knows our weather is changing. I mean, any of us who've been here a while, we just wonder what happened to the winters we used to have. And it's really ominous for the well-being of the planet in every single way. So Vermonters have been leaders on addressing climate change, and I want to hang in there and keep up my work on climate change. So I got to tell you, it's a special place, Vermont. We all know that. And the civility we have with one another, the respect we have even for people that we disagree with, our focus on what's the problem, how do we solve it, how do we work together to do it, that's been consistent all my life in Vermont. That's how I see Vermonters treating one another. And I really see my job in Congress is trying to bring that Vermont approach to Washington. And that is tough because a lot of folks don't have that Vermont approach. But that's what we need more of.
Congressman, before we let you run, I just was wondering, there are three Democrats that have announced to run for hopefully to win election for your seat. Well, of course, they have to win a primary election in August. Do you have any plans to endorse one of them, or will you wait to see the outcome of the primary?
No, I'm going to let Vermont voters decide, but let me tell you something. As one Vermonter who's watching that race, we've got three really good candidates.
So no endorsements then until the voters have spoken in August?
That's right.
All right. Greg, I think we have about 30 seconds left for one more quick question, if you have one on your list there.
Actually, I think we're set. I wish I had one more zinger left, but I don't have anything in the chamber right now. So
well, I want to express my gratitude to you. You know, local journalism is essential, but under assault, it's really difficult. And I just want to express to you my gratitude that you're doing this service for the folks in Vermont, in southwestern Vermont, especially.
Well, thank you very much, Congressman. We appreciate your time today, and you're sharing your views on some of these events that are going on right now. Gosh, we didn't even talk about COVID once for the last half hour. That's I hope that's indicative of something good, but anyway.
Let's hope. Okay.
we thought that was the case last summer, and then it didn't quite work out that way. Well, anyway, I guess that'll have to we'll have to leave it there for today. But again, thank you, Congressman Walsh, for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The time for this. Greg Sakenik, of course, reports and writes for the Bennington Banner, the Manchester Journal, and the Brattleboro Reformer. And we're really pleased to have him with us today. And we're also very pleased that you were able to join us as well, our audience. We hope you found our program interesting and informative. And, well, we'll see you again the next time, whenever that may turn out to be. Meanwhile, have a great day.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.